You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the importance of youth civic engagement, especially during the 2020 election year. Now, since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Wisconsin has seen a big influx in filed unemployment claims since the virus forced businesses to shut their doors. The almost exponential increase in claims in a short period of time has created a backlog of unfilled or unapproved claims with the State Department of Workforce Development that's left many in Wisconsin with no income. Our next guest joins us to talk about how the agency is responding to these unemployment claims and what still needs to be done. Caleb Frostman is the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Frostman, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Well, where are we now? What does our backlog look like in Wisconsin when it comes to unemployment claims?
Sure. As of Monday, which is yesterday, we are at about 86.7% of all weekly claims, about 4 million weekly claims since March 15th, have been resolved. So that means they've been paid or they have been denied, or there are a few other really small categories in there as well. But that leaves about 13.3% of all weekly claims in adjudication, which is just a big word for investigating eligibility. And that can be a really simple fix. It can be nine really challenging questions. And so we've got a really highly qualified, hardworking staff working through that caseload, putting in long hours to make sure we can get folks paid as quickly as possible.
The big concern was, okay, for a lot of people, the system is functioning as designed. It's turning around okay. But for some of those people in that adjudication process, they've raised concerns that it's dragged on for weeks, even months for them. Do we have a handle on how many people have those longer-term unresolved applications still outstanding?
We do. And so we've, based on the urgency of the folks claiming unemployment insurance, have been working hard to prioritize those oldest claims first. And so when we look at our caseload of what's left as far as, weeks in adjudication, we are around that, 5% mark for weeks that were claimed in March. So that doesn't mean the claim was started in March. It might have been started later and backdated, but it gradually, goes up week by week through the end of the last week we have information, which is in June. So that 13.3% is all weeks claimed. But going back to those earliest weeks, we see the smallest number of claims outstanding, which is, what we want to see is we prioritize those earliest weeks. And as we release those holds and, work through adjudication on those earliest claims, those often release a number of later weeks. And so we'll see kind of a waterfall effect. But, prioritizing those oldest claims first has helped us, have that the newest claims, have the largest number of claims that are still held. But we're at that 13.3% mark over the course of the last 12, 13 weeks since March 15th. But we're looking at, a graduated scale, with much lower numbers for those first few weeks and first few months.
For those people, that's 5% of those oldest claims still unresolved. What would you say to them? Are there ways that their situation, their application can be expedited to resolve it one way or another, whether the claim is ultimately approved or not?
I think the best thing we can have folks do is continue to file your weekly claims online. It's really important to do that because if you're found to be eligible, you'll get all pay you're entitled to, including back pay, but that requires continuing to file weekly claims. But as far as what they can do, I think make sure it's interesting during this time, we'll be making phone calls. Our adjudicators take phone calls and make phone calls and just try to be as timely as possible. And that also goes for employers. Oftentimes we have to determine the situation or the circumstances around a separation, and that can take some time with calls to an employer and to the claimant. So just being timely in any return phone calls is really important. And then if anyone, is either losing a job again in this pandemic or for the first time, just making sure as much as possible that initial claim is accurate and clean, because if those are inputted accurately and cleanly, we can see payments for many claimants within a week. So it's just a matter of making sure we're timely and responsive. And of course, our staff continues to work hard to make sure we're doing all we can on our end to move those claims forward.
We're talking to Caleb Frostman, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development, looking at unemployment claims here in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about the process or an experience, if you're one of the people who's been waiting for an answer for a long time, or if the system worked great for you. Love to hear either stories and all points in between. 800-642-1234. Secretary Frostman, the state Republicans have been pretty critical of how the DWD has reacted so far. In a statement, this is from last month, a group of lawmakers say, quote, "We continue to be disappointed at the slow response of this administration, their lack of success getting emergency financial assistance to people in need. We hope these issues get addressed readily, because every day DWD delays positive action is another day our constituents wait for vital financial assistance." Some of their critiques include, they say the agency hadn't utilized bipartisan legislation to bring employees of other state agencies in to handle claims. How do you respond to that criticism?
Sure. And in this time, you know, there's certainly going to be, partisan thoughts on this. And we, you know, have certainly have done all we can from the very beginning. I think the biggest piece that, we've tried to work on is the staffing level. With the volume that we saw, you know, the no other, economic crisis has been like this. We've gone from 3% unemployment in the middle of March to about 13% the following month. No one's ever seen volume like this. And so to get on top of the caseload, we needed to hire a number of staff. And so I think we feel really optimistic that we've got about 1,000 new people on board. I think over 1,000 as far as new staff, as far as intergovernmental transfers, and as far as vendors on calls, on claims processing and adjudication. So we've gone from about 500 employees at the onset of COVID to about 1,600 or 1,700 in a matter of a number of months. And it's been, really important for us to vet those candidates thoroughly, make those hires, of course, but then train them thoroughly, because it's one thing to take a phone call. It's another to, be able to answer questions and add value to a claimant's experience. And, of course, the folks that are doing adjudication and claims processing have to be thoroughly trained as well. And some of those folks take 1 to 4 weeks. And so we've been, working since day one to make sure we can address this. And just the unprecedented volume coupled with, a 50-year-old mainframe technology system that's been really difficult to onboard these new federal programs. It's just been a real challenge. So we've been really, working hard and putting in long hours to make sure we can get this done. And the team at DWD has been sticking their nose to the grindstone for the last 3 months to make sure that can happen.
Another criticism had been that you hadn't expanded hours during which people could call in. What has changed? Are you looking to expand possible call-in hours even more?
Sure. And so it's interesting. I think it's important to note that, the call center hours are certainly, important as far as customer service. And there are some things that can be handled over the phone as far as clearing up questions. But, the vast majority of what's going to be clearing claims are our claims processors and adjudicators. And we've been adding those in droves since day one. And it was important for us to have an adequate number of staff on the phones to be able to answer the volume of calls that were coming in. So it's really kind of a, walk and chew gum, add staff. And as we do that, expand hours. We've already expanded hours once by about 2 hours. And then just this week, we expanded hours again by an hour and 15 minutes each workday, excuse me. And then also added our first Saturday hours this coming Saturday, July 11th. We will start Saturday hours from 7 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. So it's been important to us to provide customer service, but we want to be able to provide adequate customer service with the number of staff required to provide quality service to our clients, not just say that we have longer hours with the same number of people answering the same number of calls. We want to be able to answer more calls in the same amount of time. So we've been doing that as staff has come on board.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rose is with us in Green Bay. Rose, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Rose?
I'm one of those people that have been waiting for about 8 weeks, as well as about 40 of my coworkers, and each and every one of us has not seen any payments at all. And we all have the same pending thing. And I'm just reaching out saying, I get it that you're overwhelmed, but at what point, like now I'm using my savings, I can't put rent on a credit card and get a late fee, and it's a snowball effect. So what I want to know is when it says pending, did I do something wrong? Did all my coworkers do it incorrectly? Like I don't see, we've all tried to answer the questions appropriately, and what, how long can we still anticipate the wait?
Rose, thanks. Good luck to you and your coworkers. Secretary Frostman, what does this pending mean for Rose and her colleagues?
Sure, and great question, Rose. And so pending does not necessarily mean anyone did anything wrong. It just means that there's further investigation needed, whether that's from your current employer or from past employers. Just the laws governing unemployment insurance in Wisconsin and the U.S. require that we investigate all employment and wages over the base period, which is 18 months. So it does not indicate that anyone did anything wrong. It just indicates that there's additional work that has to happen to determine eligibility for your claim. And so it does not mean anything went wrong. It just means that we've got additional work to do on our end.
We're talking to Caleb Frostman. Thanks for that call, Rose. Caleb Frostman is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. He's with us to talk about what's happening with unemployment claims and procedures in the state amid the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how unemployment claims are handled? What changes would you like to see in this process? Are you waiting for your claim to be to get a response? Or did you apply and the system worked for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, of course, we can't check on the status of your individual unemployment claim here on the air. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about how the state is handling unemployment cases amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guest is Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how the state handles unemployment claims? The newest wrinkles from federal relief efforts. If you have experience applying for unemployment, has it gone well? Has it gone poorly lately for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Dan is with us in Dodgeville. Dan, hello.
Yes, hello, Ron. Good afternoon. I was just wondering, how are you doing with the self-employed claims?
Self-employed claims, Secretary Frostman, and as I understand it, this was a new change from that federal relief effort, the CARES Act.
It is, yep. So that program is called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, or PUA, and we've gotten about 70,000 PUA applications, and we've paid about 10,000 of those. We're continuing to work through PUA, and the issue with PUA and how it's different than regular UI, at least is how we process it, it's much more a manual process. Our system, antiquated as it is, has a lot of the data in it that's necessary to determine, in some cases, eligibility, but also the dollar amount that someone is eligible for when it comes to standard unemployment insurance. Whereas PUA, someone in our department has to analyze both eligibility and then determine the monetary amount. So it takes longer. We've also really expanded that staff, obviously, based on the volume of claims that are coming in. And we're seeing a really strong progress week over week and even day over day as far as how many PUA claims we are processing and paying. But certainly understand we'd like to move that faster for us, but also for, of course, claimants throughout Wisconsin that have applied for pandemic unemployment insurance. Unemployment assistance.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to go back to something you were saying a few minutes ago, Secretary Frostman, about investigating older claims. One of our reporters here at WPR had profiled some people and their experience with unemployment. And in one case, a holdup was, you know, a previous job that they'd had in that 18-month time frame. They weren't clear on whether they were technically fired or laid off. Is that the kind of little question that can put a snag in the process and delay the full processing of an application?
It can, yeah. So those type of separation circumstances can have an effect in adjudication. It's those callbacks, and if there are multiple employers and multiple separations over the course of that 18-month period, you know, as we follow the laws of the Department of Labor and state unemployment insurance, those are the issues that can cause, you know, headaches for claimants and delays in adjudication. So those are some of the things that can hold up a claim in adjudication.
What other groups, we mentioned self-employed, are there other groups that can apply for unemployment compensation that couldn't have before the CARES Act?
Sure. Well, I think the self-employed, freelancers are also under PUA, as are independent contractors. So PUA is meant to kind of catch those folks that wouldn't otherwise be eligible. And then there's also, I think, a 12-item checklist as it relates to COVID-19 for that wouldn't otherwise qualify for regular unemployment insurance. And then the third and final federal program through the CARES Act is known as Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, or PEUC, and that's to provide benefits to those that have exhausted their UI eligibility. They've used all their weeks, and PEUC allows for 13 more weeks of benefits, and that also, just like PUA, regular state UI, and then PEUC, through July 25th, get that additional $600 a week through Federal Pandemic Unemployment Compensation, or FPUC.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Thank you. Secretary Frossman, I'm sorry, but I've been familiar with this unemployment system in the state of Wisconsin for decades. And even under supposedly ideal conditions, it worked very, very badly. It was incredibly slow, very Byzantine. I've lived in other states, for instance, Minnesota, and unemployment claims are taken care of in a fraction of the time. I've watched both political parties in the state of Wisconsin fail to improve this system. I've never once heard the secretary in charge of it, appointed from any party, complain to the legislature that it needed to be updated and upgraded. Can you explain this, please?
Secretary Frossman, a bipartisan failure to update the system over the last couple decades, Marcus says.
Sure. Well, I can certainly, you know, speak to some of the issues regarding modernization. So a lot of lessons were learned coming out of the Great Recession, and the system in 2014, 15, 16 through 18 was not upgraded. A lot of these issues were laid bare during that time frame, and the system, there wasn't a push to modernize then. When the new administration came in with Governor Evers and myself in January of 2019, we did begin exploring modernization and actually had vendor demonstrations and cost estimates, and COVID-19 hit before we could move forward, but had five or six different vendor demonstrations. And part of the issue, that's involved in this is the funding mechanisms for unemployment insurance are federal. So unemployment insurance in Wisconsin is federally funded. And a big portion of those formulas is based on kind of the perceived economic status, and a big piece of that is the unemployment rate. So when the unemployment rate is low and the economy is doing well, we don't have excess funds to invest in things like modernization, which, you know, based on our demonstrations last year, could cost $50 or $100 million. And so it does take, you know, some foresight to make those asks and to have that difficult conversation. But, you know, one of the lessons learned of this is, of course, again, to the urgency to modernize. But, you know, to even, you know, look at what the funding formulas look like going forward, that, you know, when these pandemics hit and we get extra dollars, they get spent on, you know, IT patches and, you know, huge staffing increases. And so then when the economy improves, those dollars go away. And it's kind of this vicious cycle where the funding formulas do not allow for adequate investment when times are good ahead of the next recession.
Marcus, thanks for the call. We're talking to Caleb Frossman, Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development. Time for another caller, I think. Becky is with us in Oshkosh. Becky, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Becky?
Yes, the reason I'm calling is because I'm a freelance writer, and I lost one of my biggest freelance gigs due to the pandemic. I did not lose all of them, but this was the one that made up the most of my income. So my question is, do I qualify for unemployment?
Thanks for the call, Secretary Frossman.
Sure. Without knowing all the specifics of your case, sure, I can't speak to specific eligibility, but I would certainly encourage you to apply. It sounds like you'd probably be a better fit for PUA based on, you know, the freelance nature of the work, which is that pandemic unemployment assistance. And that runs to the end of the year. And if there's if you lost that job weeks or months ago, there's the potential for back pay for both PUA and for that extra $600 a week. So I would certainly encourage you to apply potentially for unemployment insurance first to perhaps be denied, which would allow you to apply for PUA as well. But it sounds like a better fit for PUA.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. Secretary Frostman, our last couple minutes, I want to turn it now from unemployment and getting those payments out to efforts to get people employed in Wisconsin. What kind of things do we have going around the state to help get people back into the workforce?
Sure. Well, it's been a pretty challenging couple of months, but early on in the pandemic, we were able to set up a new page on our Job Center of Wisconsin website to help marry those businesses that were still open and at that time considered essential and the folks that were looking for additional work. And that was seems to have been highly successful in connecting those folks. But it's interesting, our more traditional training and investment programs have stayed pretty steady. And we've actually gotten just this week announced a $9 million grant to expand apprenticeship in Wisconsin. And I think we're really excited about that for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is I think we've been pretty surprised and pleased with how well virtual instruction has gone for apprentices in Wisconsin. And obviously that's a way to earn a living wage while learning an in-demand transferable skill that earns a credential that follows you everywhere. And then we also continue to work on our grant programs like Wisconsin Fast Forward, looking for opportunities to help get the unemployed employed and help the folks that are currently working earn higher wages and have credentials, follow them throughout their career. So it's been an interesting, obviously, couple of months, but as we hopefully transition into recovery mode, our agency is a full-service agency that does unemployment insurance, but it also has a very robust employment and training division that is doing great work, and we're hopeful that those efforts are going to pay off here as Wisconsin continues to recover.
Secretary Frostman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Caleb Frostman is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. He joined us today to talk about what's happening with the unemployment system here in the state amid the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. Coming up, we'll talk about the role younger people can play in politics and how the youth vote could play a crucial role in the 2020 election here, maybe here in Wisconsin in particular. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of a new book about Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy and the impact of his anti-communist campaign in Washington. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the United States historically has had pretty low turnout from voters between the ages of 18 and 29, especially compared to other countries. There's a lot of speculation as to why young people are seemingly less engaged in the political process compared to voters in other age groups. But 2020 has been a tumultuous time for people across the country, and young people in particular seem to be more involved as the Black Lives Matter movement gains more national momentum and in response to President Trump's time in office. Our next guest joins us to talk about youth civic engagement at the national level. Later in the show, a Wisconsin organizer joins us to talk about initiatives to get young people in the state involved in the political process. Abby Kisa is the Director of Impact for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE, at Tufts University. Abby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
What do you see when it comes to youth involvement in politics and, I guess, younger voters defined roughly 18 to 29-ish? What do we see about their level of involvement in 2020?
Yeah, the past 6 weeks, the country has seen what many young organizers and what we've known for a really long time, that young people are not apathetic. And what we're really dealing with respect to elections, as you mentioned, are issues of access. Voting among some young people is below their elders, like you said, but it's also been like that for decades. So it's not an issue of Gen Z or millennials. We have ongoing structural issues in our democracy with how our democracy includes or doesn't include people new to it. But young people are pushing for change in many other ways. We've seen since 2016, the number of young people marching and demonstrating going from 5% to 27%. And we've also seen the numbers of young people who are volunteering for political campaigns also skyrocket. So young people are showing that they're not apathetic, that they're interested, and they're trying to use many different channels to say we want change, and we want change on issues that impacts our everyday lives.
Part of the point it sounds like you're making is that voting is a form of political participation, is not the only form of political participation we should be paying attention to. Is that right?
Young people are engaged in so many different ways in their communities, and young organizers are making the calls about which levers that they need to pull to try to make change and push for change based on what they've seen work in their different communities. And so, you know, young folks are super smart in this way and are using many different strategies to bring about the change that they, their families, and people who they love need.
When it comes to pushing that lever or drawing that line or whatever the case may be in a particular voting booth, I think some people just accept it as, you know, kind of a fact of life. You mentioned this goes back generations. Younger people aren't as likely to vote, but that's okay. As they grow older, they'll start doing it. Why isn't that okay to just accept a lower voter turnout among young people?
It's not okay because we live in a diverse democracy, and we cannot be okay with an electorate that doesn't represent the diversity of the United States, and it doesn't. And so we know from research that young people, that, you know, voting is a habit and something that's learned. So if we see inequities when young people are just coming into the electorate and learning about how to vote, it's likely that those inequities and those differences in participation will continue to last into decades and, you know, and impact the type of electorate and the diversity of the electorate that we have. And so we focus on young people because we think that young people are about strengthening, that focusing on young people can be a way that we can strengthen and have a diverse democracy.
We're talking to Abby Kisa, Director of Impact for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. Talk about youth engagement in the political process. We're looking at the voters aged 18 to 29. Mostly, you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are one of the people in that age, do you vote? Do you get involved in politics in other ways? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. Abby, your organization, Circle, looked at the possible impact of youth votes in states around the country. When it comes to the presidential campaign, if I'm reading you right, Wisconsin is number one. Why do we see potential for youth votes making a big impact in the presidential election here in the state?
Well, let's be clear. Young people are in a position to affect contests in states and districts all over the country, from Arizona to Montana to Wisconsin to Kansas, Alabama, and Maine. But Wisconsin is ranked number one for the presidential race because of the closeness of the races that we've seen in the past, the way that young people have cast ballots. You know, in 2018, there was a strong emphasis among young people on the Democratic candidates for statewide office. And we've seen strong youth participation from young people in Wisconsin before. So there's a high likelihood that young people are going to have a big influence on the results of the presidential election in Wisconsin. And we know this because we've gathered and analyzed data from many different places and put them into a model. And Wisconsin came out number one, and it's not surprising.
Do you see structural barriers that could be fixed that would make it easier for younger people to vote that might be keeping them, nudging them at least away from voting now?
Well, in the context of this global pandemic, we see very particular issues. So, for example, there are young people in a recent June youth poll that we did, we found that there's actually a lot of young people that don't understand that online voter registration is available and can avail themselves of it if they know where to go. And so we have some work to do. Media have work to do. You know, other young people have work to do, like they're always doing. Youth organizations can do this work to let young people know how to register to vote online. And, you know, one of the things that's unique about Wisconsin is the same day registration piece. But in a year like this, you know, same day registration raises some complicated issues. And so young people need to be hearing in this moment about the changing, you know, processes that are happening in elections, which makes local media critical. It makes organizations like Lit, who we'll talk to a little bit later, absolutely critical to invest in right now so young people know where and how to participate.
Now, your group, Circle, has done surveys of the 18 to 29-year-old voting demographic about this year's election. And I know, of course, there are going to be a lot of different opinions and backgrounds in that. What kind of things stood out to you when it came to the issues, the political issues that that age group is interested in?
Well, I think it's really important to point out that young people, as you say, are absolutely diverse in so many ways. And one of the ways, and this means that the issues that young people care about and say are a priority for how they vote can be really different. You know, we saw in 2018, especially among young Black and Latino women, that racism and violence against communities of colors was a particular concern. So it's not surprising this year that we see racism even more important to young people of color, especially Black youth, in our poll. And we see it as something that's important amongst all youth, but it's particularly important amongst young people of color. And the other issues that also rise to the top include healthcare, obvious in this moment. You know, for young people, the environment and climate change is also a real issue and also a climate justice issue. And so it can really differ. And it's important to understand that because there's no one issue that can mobilize all young people because their experiences are so diverse.
We're talking to Abby Kisa, Director of Impact for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE, at Tufts University. She's with us to talk about the youth vote, the role young people ages 18 to 29 or so will play in the 2020 election. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the role younger people play in the election process, in politics more generally? How would you like to see more youth engagement? If you're under the age of, say, 30, how, if in any way, do you plan to be involved in this year's political process? If you're older than 30, you know, were you involved in politics in some way, a lot, a little at that age? Did you make sure to start voting right away? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the importance of the youth vote in elections and how young people could impact the 2020 race and how those voters 18 to 29 are involved in politics on Election Day and beyond. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're in this age group, 18 to 29 or so, do you vote? Do you plan to vote in November? Are you involved in politics in other ways? If you are older, how do you make the case maybe to younger people in your family to be engaged with the political process? What do you remember about your political involvement at a younger age? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Abby Kisa stays with us, Director of Impact for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, or CIRCLE, at Tufts University. Maya Neal joins us now. She's Political Strategy Manager for Leaders Igniting Transformation, or LIT, which is based in Milwaukee. She's with us to take a look at some initiatives happening here in Wisconsin. Maya, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What kind of things are you and your organization doing to reach out and get younger voters engaged in the political process?
Yeah, so young people are focused at LIT. We're a Black and Brown youth-led organization. So in this election cycle, because we know that young people are often disenfranchised from their right to vote due to voter ID laws, unclear direction, you know, changing rules and laws. So we're ensuring that young people across the state have access to their vote by making sure that they're registered to vote, that they know to request and return an absentee ballot, and no information about their upcoming election. And the way that we're doing that is heavily focused on digital organizing. We are going to be doing some outreach by mail to connect our base with information about voter registration and upcoming election deadlines. But we're also mostly going to be texting and calling voters, providing information online, and then using social media and other digital engagement tools to get folks involved with the process.
on a really practical level. One thing about a younger demographic is they may change addresses, whether moving out of a parent's home, going off to college, or maybe they're more likely to rent and change addresses. Is that something you run into with making sure young people are registered to vote and you know, voting at the right place?
Yes, that's a question that we get a lot in our outreach, that in regards to change of address, but also in terms of, you know, do I vote where I'm in college or do I vote back at home? So that question does come up a lot. And so folks are needing a lot of clarification in terms of where the right place for them to vote is and, you know, how to ensure that, you know, the information is shown that they, you know, live at this address and it might be different from their ID. So finding proof of address can be difficult. So we do a lot of walking folks through those questions.
I want to bring on a caller now. CJ is with us in Racine. CJ, hello.
Hi, yes. Thanks for having me on. One of the things that caught my fancy about getting involved in local government from a young age is seeing the number of young candidates and young local officials that have been added on in recent years in both my city and my county, and realizing that this young demographic, I'm 25 myself, I do have two kids and I'm married, so that's out of the norm, but I'm still young, is we make up a large population in this area, as well as a large population that's being affected by the biggest issues of our days. And I wanted there to be accurate representation in local government, and I wanted somebody to be there to stand up for those who are in a hard spot right now. There's a lot of people that are trying to move away because they can't raise their young families or they're worried about what their future looks like. And I wanted there to be an option for those who love their city, who wanted to stay and make it better.
CJ, thanks a lot for that call. So CJ, thinking maybe even about running for local government. Maya, let's start with you on this. Is that something you are working on, not just getting people to vote or organize politically, but to be candidates themselves?
Yeah, definitely. We are, in our approach, we are making sure that in everything that we do, we're developing kind of the next wave of Wisconsin leaders, activists, organizers, and elected officials. So we think it's very important to make sure that in all levels of government, there's representation of young Black and brown folks making decisions and at the tables that are going to affect their lives and their futures.
Thanks for that call. And Abby, I want to bring you in on this. What do we know about younger people, not just voting or working on a campaign, but being the campaign, actually running for office?
Well, it's not unusual at all for young people to be volunteering with campaigns and being in that environment. We've seen that number triple between 2016 and now. And I also think that, you know, when we look at what happened in 2018, a really diverse candidate slate across the country and young people voting for that diverse candidate slate across the country, you know, especially in federal offices, right? This is something that young people want to see, right? Representation that Maya is talking about is critically important, right? Not only in politics, but also in places like media. And all of this together creates a culture where young people can see themselves in the work, see themselves in decision-making places, and know that, you know, they should be there.
In our last minute or so, Maya, if younger people are listening around the state, maybe younger people of color, and want to do something like you're doing there in Milwaukee, what would you encourage them to do?
Yeah, first and foremost, I'd always encourage folks to get connected with our work. They can check us out online at litmke.org. But I'd also encourage young people to remember that, you know, your elected officials work for you. And I'm really inspired by the way that young people are so passionate and so about action and actual change. I think that that needs to be advocated in our leaders. They work for us. And so they need to be held accountable to the standards that we have and to the needs that we have if they're going to, you know, receive our vote and receive our support.
And Abby, just 15 seconds, Abby, 15 seconds or so. What are you watching for in 2020?
We've seen, like Maya said, young people of color have a huge influence on elections across the country. And with their leadership, especially young women of color, I feel like that is something we're going to see be very big in 2020.
Abby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Maya, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Maya Neal, Political Strategy Manager for Leaders Igniting Transformation, or LIT, based in Milwaukee, and Abby Kisa, Director of Impact for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. They joined us to talk about the role young people play in politics, especially in this year's election cycle. Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. 85-year-old Beverly Bleets moved into a senior living facility in Door County in 2018. She's a former recreational pilot and was used to a life of independence. When the pandemic hit, the facility went on lockdown, and Bleets suddenly found herself without her beloved freedom.
My calendar is blank. I'm facing a summer devoid of holiday celebrations, concerts, theater, picnics, and most of all, my family that lives 10 minutes away. Our town is a tourist destination, as are the other small towns in the surrounding countryside. People come here for the culture and the picturesque Cape Cod of the Midwest. Our towns take turns celebrating everything from bonfires on the beach on the first day of summer to the blazing colors of fall with festivals, fairs, and fireworks. Not so this summer. My world as an art gallery docent, community volunteer, and Uber driver has been canceled. What if this is to be my last summer on Earth? Because if it is, should I be making decisions to redirect the life I have left? There is risk in everything we do, more critical since the pandemic, but I believe there must be more out there for all of us, not just me. The people around me are despondent and desperate for conversation with a friendly face. Our chaplain worries as she sees decline in residents as well as patients. In the future, will we look back on these days as irreparably damaging to an aging population? Will we better understand or even accept the brutality of isolation? My daughter has invited me to stay with her for the summer. The prospect is delicious. Her condo is spacious, the community picturesque, and the landscape is tranquil. But she's met the challenge of many changes in her life, and I'm reticent to intrude. Yet her invitation sparks ideas of freedom from the lockdown that has become so oppressive, that continues to make me feel old and stale. I've begun to consider alternatives, though, and have fun reading the rental classifieds, dreaming of leaving, of getting away from this lockdown. But getting away still means safer at home, and I realize that my lifestyle will not change with a new landscape. I am and will continue to long for the habits that brought me joy. But now I'm fearful of people I know and love, of places harboring potential pandemic, and of things I cannot see. I awakened this morning, remembering that I had my favorite dream again. I was flying my airplane in the cockpit alone, taxiing out to the run-up pad, then, without a sound, cleared for takeoff, throttle forward, the surge of power accelerating. It took me back 40 years to my first solo flight, and that heart-skipping moment of liftoff, breaking the bonds of earth and free again. In Paige's guest room now, for the summer, in remembering, I was afraid to move, to break away from the delicious feeling that memory brought. That feeling of freedom now, safe and secure, doors and windows open to the Wisconsin morning.
That story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, a series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, humans evolved as a migratory species, and our willingness to move could help save our species in the future. We'll hear from the author of The Next Great Migration. We'll look at the latest news in national politics, including releases that show who benefited from business relief loans from the federal government. And we'll find out how Wisconsin prison officials are trying to halt the spread of COVID-19 among inmates and staff. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, a lot more customers got into online shopping in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. Kate's guest brings us up to date on the latest trends in online retail and the new ways you can pay for stuff. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, if you spent time on farms or in rural areas decades ago, you may have heard birds like meadowlarks more often. Today, those songs are more rare. We'll talk with the author of a book that looks at how farming and wildlife shared the land in past generations and how we can recover some of that balance with different practices and policies. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.